You're listening to the OCD Stories podcast, hosted by me, Stuart Ralph. The OCD Stories is a podcast dedicated to raising awareness and understanding around obsessive compulsive symptoms. I do this through interviewing inspired therapists, psychologists, and people who have experienced OCD. Welcome to the OCD Stories. Welcome to episode 273, and in this episode I interview Dr. Michael Tuhig. Michael is the co-director of the Utah State University ACT Research Group, a licensed psychologist in the state of Utah, and a professor of psychology at Utah State University. So I've wanted to get Michael on since 2016, when I was doing my first master's dissertation, where I was looking at ACT specifically for OCD, and I was doing a systematic review of the studies that had been done. So around that time, I got to see a lot of the work Michael had been doing over the years, specifically looking at how ACT could be used to treat OCD. So in this episode, I chat with Michael about his research and acceptance commitment therapy, or ACT, story, his experience of training under Dr. Stephen Hayes, what is ACT, why he studied ACT initially as a sole intervention for OCD, and what he found. He breaks down the 8-session ACT protocol he used in his research. We talk about psychological flexibility and why it's important. We discuss cognitive diffusion and integrating ACT with exposure and response prevention therapy. We talk about how bringing in values into therapy can be helpful, some of the metaphors he likes for OCD, and so much more. Really enjoyed this conversation, and I like the way Michael explained ACT in relation to OCD. I think it's going to be useful to many of you. And thanks as always to NoCD for supporting the show and the work that we do. NoCD are now operating in Australia as well as UK and USA. So good work to NoCD for continuing their expansion. And thank you to them for sponsoring the show. And if you want to find out more, head to go.treatmyocd.com/theocdstories or click the link in the episode description. And thank you to you guys as always for listening. I deeply appreciate it. And without further ado, here is Dr. Michael Tuhig. Welcome to the show, Michael.
Thanks, Stuart.
Yeah, it's good to have you here. So it'd be good to hear, you know, your therapy story, your research story, just what got you in those areas, and then specifically around ACT.
Yes, I will try to make it brief because it's almost a 20-year story now, but I'll give you the tight version of it. So I started out with a master's in behavior analysis, working with a guy named Doug Woods. And if you track that name, he's sort of famous for work with Tourette syndrome and trichotillomania. So my work with him was, I was doing basic behavioral work with adults with trichotillomania, and they kept saying things like, "I'd like to stop, but the urge is too strong." And behavior analysts didn't really have an answer to like how to help them with that urge. It's sort of like, we'll just wait and it'll go away. Like, I didn't have language to talk to them about that as a behavioral person. So everyone was like, you have to go look at the work of Steve Hayes. Steve Hayes has work on language from a behavioral standpoint. So I became kind of a Steve Hayes fan and started understanding his work, which then led me to ACT. And this was like 1999. So I integrated ACT in this behavior therapy for trichotillomania, and that paper was in 04. So that got me kind of interested in the OCD and related disorders. And jump ahead, I go do my PhD with Steve Hayes, who's probably the most associated with ACT. And I shifted into doing ACT with OCD because that seemed like a logical sort of shift from trichotillomania. So in my time with Steve, I did 2 trials of ACT for OCD. And then I spent a year working with Maureen Whittle up at the University of British Columbia because of her great OCD work. So I learned kind of how to do CBT. And then now I'm a professor at Utah State University, where I run an ACT research lab with my colleague, Mike Levin. And I'd say I'm 80% researching ACT for OCD and related disorders. And I've been doing that for about 15 years now, and now do it in a handful of countries and, you know, not just in our lab, but we've been at it I've been doing this for pretty much my whole career, about 20 years.
Yeah. Amazing. does your lab research, so you're focused primarily on OCD and related disorders. Does the lab do other disorders as well?
Well, the guy that I'm paired with, his name is Mike Levin, and he's excellent, and I'm very, very lucky to get to work with him. His main area is ACT via technology. Okay. So he tests books, mobile apps, websites, and then we've started to do telehealth maybe in the last 5 years. So kind of the overall lab interest is like, how do you deliver ACT across as many platforms as possible, and then the integration of the platforms? So Mike is sort of flexible on the group he works with, which sometimes makes me flexible, but still my students really prefer OCD and related disorders. So by and large, we keep ending up back there every time we think of a new project.
Yeah. Yeah, excellent. Annie, I was actually watching a video on your website, which I'll link to, is in the clinic, the research lab's website. And you were talking about some of those technological examples, like the app and the website.
Right.
And
right.
Yeah, it's interesting. Yeah, and it was interesting because you were talking about Zoom, and you were talking, this was 2019, I think you gave the talk. And now because of COVID, it's commonplace, you know, that using Zoom and doing therapy online. And but yeah, right. It was, think about 18 months ago, I was doing episodes on teletherapy, trying to convince people of, you know, this should be more commonplace. I mean, I like doing in-person therapy personally, but for ease of access. And now it's like, it's a given. No one pushes against it, or some do, but you know, most don't. Anyway, I'm waffling now. So what was it like training under Stephen Hayes?
What was it like? Well, whenever someone pauses, you know, it's a meaningful answer. Here's some of the things that stood out when working with them, that there's kind of a story that usually a student and an advisor will start to get on each other's nerves towards the end. Because it's like the student feels like they know what they're doing and they want to go do it. And the advisor is still telling them like, no, you still have to check with me. You can't just do whatever you want. When I worked with Steve, like I felt like I never caught up. Like I never understood things close to as well as he did. And then it's very interesting, since I graduated, he just keeps going. Like he just keeps sort of moving on to the next like meaningful idea. So that was interesting. Like the man is really wise and he is very forward thinking. So he was wonderful to get to hang around with, but you never felt like you quite understood what was going on. Cause it was always like, if I was going 50 miles an hour, he was going 100. And so you never quite caught up, but you kept learning. And the other thing that was great is in Steve's lab, you know, there's a lot of people in there, maybe 12 to 15 PhD students, or students, I should say. Some might have been masters. That was fun. Everyone was like really motivated, and we thought it was really like our work was really important, and it felt like we were doing something big, and I really liked that. And my schooling was like 2002 to 2006 with Steve, and that was before ACT was really big. So that was also a kind of a fun time because things were starting, the organization was forming, you know, the big book came out and he got in Time magazine, you know, like all that was happening during those years. So those were fun years.
Yeah. Is that the Get Out of Your Mind and Into Your Life book?
Yeah. Cause yes, when that came out, then Time magazine, which is a big US magazine, did a 6-page thing on him. Wow. And for like the week after that, like our phone didn't stop ringing. And because people would just go on the internet and try to find his phone number. So like, it was just fun being in the lab because like just funny things were happening, you know, like newspapers are just calling, and it was kind of a real entertaining phase.
Yeah. Yeah. But it was, thank you for giving your background. So like I mentioned before, many people that listen to the show regularly, you know, I touch on ACT at least once in every 4 episodes, so they should be familiar. But for those that maybe haven't heard much of my stuff, how would you describe ACT?
Right. So ACT is it's a psychotherapy that fits in the cognitive behavioral tradition. And when I usually like give a talk, I usually show an umbrella and I say like CBT is this larger idea of empirically supported time-limited interventions for, you know, specific problems. But under that umbrella, there's all sorts of forms of it, right? There's dialectical behavior therapy, exposure with response prevention, schema therapy, metacognitive therapy, and ACT. And, you know, ACT has its sort of particular model and intervention style and idea of outcomes and processes of change. And I think maybe the most like pertinent ones is ACT believes that no internal experience is good or bad. Like, so any thought or feeling that we have is just the thought or feeling that we have. And maybe its usefulness is determined by what does it lead you to do when it's there? So there are no good cognitions or bad cognitions or good feelings or bad feelings. It's just what do those feelings lead you to do in terms of how you live your life. So we try to work with clients to be able to see their internal experiences as just events that happen, create a little distance from them so they have choice, like, do I listen to it or not? And whether you listen to it or not might depend on context. And really the ultimate, like, what behavior do you do is based on what you care about. So can you feel the way you feel and think the way you think and still be the person you want to be? And that kind of happens by not taking our thoughts and feelings as literal, but sort of choosing when to listen to them and when not to listen to them.
Yeah, which is obviously important for OCD.
That lands pretty nicely with OCD.
Yeah. Okay, so your research, as you mentioned, started earlier than what I'm about to talk about, which is 2014. But I thought we could start there. So there was a review done in 2014, which specifically looked at acceptance commitment therapy studies for OCD. But these studies didn't involve any other interventions. You were only using ACT. Well, it's not you. Sorry, you were reviewing studies that only use ACT to treat OCD. Although I think one of your studies was included. Yeah, well, I guess what did you find of having ACT as the only intervention for OCD?
Right. So when I'm going to talk about earlier because it makes more sense to me. But when I did my first ACT for OCD study, which published in 06, so we probably did it in 04. I know exposure therapies are a great thing. But if I did this type of cognitive therapy, like teaching people to just notice their thoughts and not be pushed around by them and, you know, live the way you want to live, I knew if I integrated that with exposure therapy, any decent scientist would say, well, if you integrate anything with exposure therapy, it'll work. Like, you could have sushi and exposure therapy and the exposure therapy will work. So I really, like, I purposefully tried to not do any in-session exposures. And then even like the homework, it wasn't exposure looking, you know, of course the person needed to start doing the things they had stopped doing, right? Like if you were, you know, not hanging around friends because you didn't want to give them germs or get their germs. Like, we need to start hanging around friends again. So we put life activities back in, but we really didn't do any exposures. And I did that on purpose. And we got surprisingly good outcomes for the short amount of time that therapy was. So that was the 06 study. And then we got federal funding and did a large randomized trial with 40 per condition, so treatment group versus a control group, where we did it the same way. And that was a little fancier with like blind raters isn't a nice way to say it, raters who are unaware of the condition, doing the assessments and, you know, better scoring and stuff. And we got the same outcomes, like really nice response rates for not doing any in-session or sort of prescribed out-of-session exposures. But really that was more of like an experimental idea to know if there was something important in just that idea of not buying into your thoughts and living the way you want to live.
Yeah. And the results were pretty effective, pretty good.
They're good. You know, they're like, in terms of response rates, they were, you know, 50 to 60% would be considered responders, which is kind of what we get with ERP. Yeah. And then I think, as you know, the researchers from Iran have really run with this work, and they've replicated that 4 to 5 times probably.
Because obviously, as I was saying, my original dissertation was extending what you did, and I found similar results. And but in your paper, in your review, it shows that kind of ACT by itself was as effective as ERP by itself. I mean, the kind of, as you know, you have to critique everything in academia. And what came up for me, there wasn't enough randomized control trials to, like, that would be one of the big arguments as someone who would review. Yeah, but if you put more people in like we do with ERP, it would lessen maybe. But anyway, it was exciting for me to see it of, hang on a minute, here's this thing that stands by itself and is effective. Mm-hmm. What would it be like to integrate ERP? Fast forward some years, and obviously you've been answering that question. So let me find my next question. So in your original work, in your original study of ACT for OCD, it was an 8-hour manual that was created, right, session by session, of what would be done.
Right.
What could you describe some more of the things that were kind of in that? I guess because often when it's talked about on this show, it's very much talked about ACT and OCD merged together. But, and I'm not trying to push people to do just ACT. I think it's just interesting.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And you meant ACT and ERP merged, right?
What's usually talked about. But you're
you usually talk about.
Yeah.
Yeah, I'm glad you're going there. Because that is something, like, if I had, you know, the I don't want to say win the lottery, because I'd probably do something else with the money, but you know, if I got the magical grant, we've never looked at ACT alone versus an ERP. And I know not everything's the best in sort of a head-to-head comparison, but that's just not really a logically, you know, the federal government's not going to give us money for that trial. It's not necessary. But yeah, it would be interesting to know if, like, what is the outcome difference if you don't have to do those exposures, but you learn the skill that you might learn via exposure, via like typical type of psychotherapy. I would like to do that study. I know it, like, on the average, you get the same outcome, but that's the joy of a randomized trial. You're taking the same population and drawing from it and then seeing what happens. But anyways, to answer your question, yeah, should I just kind of walk through the protocol? Because unless you've really pulled it off my website or dug into it, yeah, you wouldn't really know what we do. So session one, I'll try to not drag on for too long, but
okay.
Like, there's a big part with our clients of helping them understand that the obsession and the compulsion are not one behavior. Like, they happen so tight that it feels like I feel this way, then I do this thing, or it's like, I'm going to feel this way, so I just do the thing to beat it. Mm-hmm. And really, one is this, like, independent internal event. Like, you have a thought or an emotion, and then there's this action that you, here's my stance as a therapist, you 100% have a choice to do that thing. And if you don't do the thing, you're going to feel some emotions. So we kind of go through this thing that we call creative hopelessness, which is just seeing that when you do the compulsion, it relieves the feeling really well in the short term. I know it doesn't relieve it in the long term, because if it relieved in the long term, you wouldn't be talking about it. But then actually, it's sort of the process of giving into it just really digs you deeper into a hole of, like, builds up this relationship where this obsession is the boss. It's in charge. It tells you how to live your life. And sort of in an attempt to get more control over this internal experience, you've really lost control over it. Like, it's really become the boss. And then we'll, like, move into, like, session two, where we'll talk about, and it's that way with all internal experiences. Like, I'll say, you know, try to, I don't know how much you do this around the world. I think most countries do, but before a sporting event, there's a national anthem. And I'll say something like, you know, would it be possible to go out and sing the national anthem? And if I put a
galvanic skin response in your fingers? Like, would it be possible to feel no anxiety? Like, and I'll like give you whatever you want. I'll buy you a new car if you can experience no anxiety. And, you know, 99% of people say that's ridiculous. Of course, you will feel this feeling of anxiety. And it's like, while they know that it's not possible to choose what emotions you have, they still feel like they can choose to not have this emotion. Like that this one's different. And I say it's different in kind, but not in function. Like, it's this, emotions can't be controlled. Just like if I said, don't think of the next thing I'm about to say, like a penguin with a top hat. Like, people are going to think of it because we don't get to choose what pops in our head and we don't get to choose what we feel, but we can choose what we do. So if I say, like, you know, don't touch your iPhone, which I'm imagining most of us have one near us, you can choose to not touch it. And I'm sure we can all succeed. That's kind of the idea, that internal stuff's pretty hard to control. Behavior is pretty easy to control. So our therapy is about choosing what you do and making some space for how you feel. Should I keep going? Or
yeah, please. It's interesting. Yeah.
So then the next couple sessions have a lot to do with helping the client get some distance from that internal experience, or the obsession, I should just say. So we teach, you know, like willingness, where we practice allowing it to be there. And, you know, like an example I might give is we teach how to allow it to be there, like an unwelcome guest at your house. Like, I have a Christmas party, and maybe I don't love every single guest who comes, but I can be welcoming and kind to everyone, even if they like how they dressed or like how they speak or something like that. And by that, I mean like they're offensive, not something else, but like they're mean, but I can still be kind to them. And then there's, you know, stepping back from thoughts, like being able to see that an obsession about something horrible is a thought about something horrible. It's not the horrible thing. And like a cute example I use with a client is I'll say, you know, imagine taking a lemon and cutting it open. And then you have half a lemon in your hand. And then imagine like putting that half a lemon in your mouth and squeezing it. And if you felt the feeling of sour, well, that's because the mind can feel and taste and experience what it pictures. So if you picture harming your child, you will feel the feelings of harming your child. But that's just the picture of, or a thought about, or a memory of. I mean, it is very different than the real thing. So we do work to help the client understand or experience that the stuff in their head is not the actual behavior. It's a picture of an event in your head. Just like there's no lemons here, we just pictured them. So that's creating some distance from the thoughts. And then I'll just kind of move ahead, you know, and we do that kind of work for a handful of sessions of helping the client sort of see thoughts are not real things that we don't have to listen to, and you can make room for them. And then ultimately, the therapy is about living a life that's meaningful and important to you. And I will be honest, most clients, I would say 80% of their life is about controlling their emotions. And I would like to make 80% of their life about doing things that are important to them. If you spent 20% of your life controlling your emotions, you're probably going to live a pretty good life. So it's about helping people see what's meaningful to them. Where do they want to spend their time? Really working hard to spend our time on that and not on regulating our feelings. And that's where the concept of behavioral commitments comes in. That's where the commitment and act is like each week we talk about meaningful changes we're going to make that are more consistent with who you want to be. So that's, you know, like, what have you lost in your life that you'd like back in? And we work on putting those steps back in. And as you do it, your mind will scream at you, and we practice being good at not being bossed around by your mind and going after the things you want. And honestly, as people do that, they get better at it and they feel some confidence and competence, and their life starts becoming more meaningful and richer.
Nice. Yeah. Thank you.
It's getting close to the end.
Yeah. Was that the final session there? Have you got,
I mean, if that would be the pattern, it's kind of,
okay,
you know, acceptance, not buying into your thoughts, talking about values, but doing behavioral commitments all the way through therapy.
So with the behavioral commitments, would that be the homework?
That would be making changes towards your values on a daily and weekly basis.
Okay. Nice. No, thank you for that. It's really useful. And play devil's advocate of, I imagine, maybe there's some hardcore ERP therapists listening, or maybe some people with OCD that have done purely ERP and they're like, hang on a minute, where's the change mechanism here? You know, I'm not facing my fears. I'm not, any of that. I'm not habituating, or I'm not getting in. Well, I was going to say not getting a new learning in terms of inhibitory learning, but sure. I think inhibitory learning and ACT are probably very similar in terms of how they work, the understanding. Sure. So what would you say the change mechanisms are here?
The change mechanism. So I love that question. And like whenever I give a talk on, ACT for OCD, there's always a part where I kind of have to talk about, think about your model if you're doing an exposure exercise. And one part is, what is your change mechanism? Like what, at a simple form, what's happening within your client that helps them function better in the world? And I can say for ACT, the change mechanism is this idea of seeing your thoughts just as thoughts, making room for them, and being able to live your life the way you choose to live it, even while they're present. So I think if you hear in there, habituation is not necessary in the slightest. And I know as I say that, someone probably was like, oh my. But one can live whatever kind of life they want to live, even if their internal stuff is kicking and screaming. And if you don't listen to it, we all know if you don't listen to it for a month, it will change. But I usually say it's not just change in terms of intensity. It's a change in terms of quality. Like I get up in front of people and speak on easily a weekly basis, more likely every other day, because that's my job as a professor and as a researcher who, teaches people about what I do. I've been doing that since I started grad school in 2000. I still feel some feelings of anxiety. I never habituated my way out of it, and I've given 1,000 lectures. But part of it is I don't care that it's there. Like I have changed my relationship with anxiety where it can be a 0 or an 8, and I don't really change my behavior. So that's part of it's changing its function, not just its intensity.
I fully agree. Like with this podcast, I've done it over 5 years now, and I still get nervous before each guest. Not if I've met them several times, that's different. But like, for example, with you, there was a small amount of nerves or anxiety, and that's fine. I don't feel like I need to remove it or get rid of it because it's meaningful.
Yeah. And I think I'm not knocking ERP again. Like I like ERP.
Yeah.
We do ERP a lot of the time with certain clients and certain contexts. And like I said, I have a behavior analytic background. Like I like exposure therapy. But the idea that the internal thing needs to be notably different to change your behavior can be a bit of a trap. Because if you're like, I'll do this podcast, I'll invite the big person once I feel strong and competent. Well, what if you never feel that way?
Yeah.
Then you're waiting for your internal stuff to be different before you can be the kind of person you want to be.
Yeah, that's a good point.
I don't really like that model. Yeah.
No. Well, yeah, I mean, I got Stephen Hayes on episode 4 of this podcast. So,
of 4?
Yeah.
That's so, you had to start big, man.
Yeah, he took a real risk on me, but I think it paid off, hopefully. But my value is always outweighed, in terms of the podcast at least.
Sure.
My anxiety. Maybe not in other areas, but it's an interesting one. And I think because of, I don't want to get bogged down in the tech or the theory, but because of inhibitory learning, I think ACT is much more accepted by therapists.
Yeah.
Because that's different to habituation, because that's come along and said, even if you don't do ACT, habituation doesn't need to happen and you're getting a new learning and blah, 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 blah. Yeah. Okay. So no, that was, thank you for that. It was interesting. Yeah. So psychological flexibility, what is it and why would you say it's important in OCD, for OCD?
Yeah. And thanks for asking that question. When you heard what is the change mechanism, and I said, you know, seeing your thoughts for what they are and making room for them and following your values, that was just me dodging saying psychological flexibility, because that term is one we just made up. It's basically the term for like, what is the thing you target and act? And that's just it. Like I don't need to say it again. Psychological flexibility is the goal of ACT. And I think one thing that I'll say that's neat about it is that idea of being psychologically flexible, it works to help someone respond to their obsessions, but it also works to help you ask someone out on a date or to take a class that you think is scary, or to, you know, if you get really extreme, to tolerate chronic pain or to not be pushed around by, you know, hallucinations if you have schizophrenia. So that what's been really cool about Psych Flex is that the ability to not to see your thoughts and feelings for what they are and not be pushed around by them and go towards your values has pretty much always been useful. Like in any context that we research it in, it works. So like at USU, we'll just do general Psych Flex interventions, which is we'll just do general ACT for like the whole college campus. And you have decreases in depression, anxiety. Like literally I just did a thesis defense today. We taught Psych Flex to high schoolers and they went to more classes. They skipped school less. You know, like it, you can kind of be more the person you want to be if you have that ability.
Yeah. Yeah. I like the term. I think if you just think about it literally in terms of like, or the physical body, if your body's not flexible, you're more likely to be prone to injury. And similar with the brain of black and white thinking and and obsessions. Yeah, that's always, it sticks in my mind of, am I being flexible here or not? Okay, so what's your view on cognitive diffusion techniques for OCD?
My view on them. So that's a cool question. Cognitive diffusion to me is, like I've been working in ACT for a long time and I think I know cognitive therapy pretty well. I feel like I've put the work in to like have some picture of it. And I think cognitive diffusion is one of these things that ACT brought to the world to CBT that wasn't really there. So what was the specific question? I think what I was saying is like, it's a new important thing and I'm glad ACT brought it. But what was your specific question about
it? Yeah, it was actually, so I've got a few ACT buddies that I asked, I said you were coming on the show and I said, have you got any questions? And this was one of them of, yeah, they want to know what's your view on cognitive diffusion techniques for OCD. And I guess we could expand that in what is it? Are there any examples?
Well, I think cognitive diffusion, to me, it's been really helpful with the treatment of OCD because there are times when someone has a pretty problematic cognition to them and or a pretty problematic obsession, and I have no way to help them work out of it. Like there's simple ones. Like if I think back to a client who's like afraid that he was going to contract HIV, and theoretically you could. We could like Google it and say, how does one contract HIV? What's the probability? And, you know, we could like look into, it's really, really unlikely that, that this would happen. Like you're sort of obsessing about an unreasonable thing, but there are a lot of obsessions. Like I'm not going to go to heaven, which they're pretty hard to help the person come to the other side and be like, oh yeah, I feel pretty good about my chances. Right. Like, yeah. I know I'm a solid person who's doing the best I can. And, you know, I've met that bar that will get me into heaven. And if cognitive diffusion is saying like, no thought is real, all thoughts are just like chatter in our head, like an announcer at a sporting event that you can choose to listen to or not listen to.
And basically, we choose to listen to them when they improve our life. And when they don't improve our life, we don't. So, like, I love my wife dearly. Sometimes my mind tells me that she's being frustrating. And then I just don't listen to that one, because when I act on that, it, you know, it doesn't improve the night. And if I have the feeling, if I have the thought I love her, I'll say, "Oh, Katie, I love you." And she'll say, "Oh, thank you." And it has never been bad when I listen to that one. So it's the same thing. If someone's, you know, obsessing about their afterlife, the mind says, you know, if you whatever, you know, don't double check that, then you might have wronged somebody. No, if that doesn't improve your life to follow that, right or wrong, if you've practiced diffusion and get it and like can kind of do it, there's a way to not listen to that thought, even though the end outcome of messing that one up would be going to hell. Like, you can recognize it's just your mind throwing things out at you. It's not real. It's no more real than that lemon I talked about.
Yeah. Yeah. Good point. Okay, so let's talk about merging it now with ERP. So
yes,
you've done some research with Dr. John Abramowitz, who's been on the show several times.
Nice.
He's obviously a good friend of yours. I guess, was he like a logical person to team up with? Because obviously his research primarily has been in ERP historically.
Yeah, John is right up there with Steve Hayes in terms of like his understanding of OCD and his sort of dedication to the topic. So he really approached me. And if you kind of like dig through our CVs, he approached me and we did a couple like laboratory projects looking at, you know, if we teach psych flex versus extinction, like how does that work with these like small parts of OCD? And I think we did one or two little studies like that, and they weren't groundbreaking. But that led us to like sort of having a good enough relationship where we got some money from the IOCDF and we did this larger trial. Yeah, and that was a big trial. So treated 60 adults with OCD. Half at his school, half at mine, but also I'm going to use the word supervised, but it's really was a consultant. He supervised all the ERP cases and I supervised all the ACT plus ERP cases at both sites. So we had like really good experimental control, assessors who were unaware of condition. And we used like a pretty intense ERP protocol. So the FOA one, that's two-hour sessions a week for 8 weeks. So it's like 16 sessions, but they're 2 hours long. So if you just, like, if I'm really being honest there, that's like 32 hours of therapy, which is like monumentally more than I've ever done. And if you ask like that, that's how I do the work in my clinic. So I run a clinic on campus. We have lots of clients with OCD and other anxiety disorders. To me, that's the most logical fashion to do this work. Like I like ACT as a model to teach psych flex. And I like exposure exercises because there's no better way to practice psych flex than with real things. So I teach how to be psychologically flexible. Really what we did with John, we taught it really quickly and then taught it during therapy. And in my own work, I teach it over a long time and then do exposure. So I might do more like 6 to 8 sessions of psych flex and then go to exposures. But you know, the end outcome with the study with John was both conditions had really high response rates. I shouldn't say really high, but like closer to 70%, which isn't what I generally get, on my own, but we are also about 4 times as much therapy, but these were pretty high success rates.
Yeah. No, that's wonderful. And I think you did a paper of like what I think I was looking at it just now. It was like kind of like what you learned, you broke down.
There's a paper in 2015 where we like really walked through how we did that therapy. And I guess a few people have said to me that we wrote it in a pretty understandable way. So
yeah,
I'm just putting that out there. If people are interested, it's a, I think it's Tuig et al. 2015. But it lays out how to do ACT plus ERP fairly clearly.
Nice. I'll try and dig it out and put in the show notes as well.
Okay.
Yeah. So kind of going back to what you said earlier about, you know, why don't you just team ERP with sushi if, you know, it's going to produce the same results. And I think the outcome of the RCT was the ACT and ERP group was similar to the ERP on its own group. So how would you defend doing ACT and ERP over the ERP, if that makes sense?
Yeah, it's a great question. It depends the context you're working in, right? So like, if I ran a residential hospital, I don't know if you have to, but when you have a client who's not where you want the client to be, then this would make sense. Then adding ACT to it would make sense. Like if you're doing ERP, you're not getting there. The other thing is, you know, if the client comes in and they're really psychologically inflexible, then ACT would also make sense. So we've done a moderation and mediation study of or analysis from that study. And I have to ponder quickly what we found. And there are, you know, I'm not 100% sure what we found, but I think this is what we found. And I know that Michelle Krask found the same thing in one of her trials, that like when someone has really high cognitive distortion, ACT can make sense. Because like if it's a thought you can't work through, then ACT can actually work better than something with stronger cognitive challenging. One of the analyses from this trial, that ACT plus ERP versus ERP, was that like across conditions, when we scored the therapy sessions, like a really good description of tolerance / acceptance, because tolerance is kind of an, you know, the more inhibitory learning model, that the stronger that description, the better the person did.
Okay.
So I think my answer is, no, I can't say we should all switch to ACT, but anyone who works in OCD or, you know, has OCD, we haven't quite nailed this thing yet.
Yeah.
Like we're not quite where we want to be in terms of the treatment of it. And, you know, people who are struggling to do ERP or are really psychologically inflexible, really caught up in their mind, this can be a really nice option. People sometimes talk about those who refuse to do exposures. It's not something I run into a lot. I feel like if someone's refusing to do exposures, you need to do the exposures more kindly. But I find that if we do ACT for a while and kind of build some psychological flexibility, then there's actually kind of an interest in doing the exposures. Mm-hmm. There's a study out there that, if you don't mind me nerding out for one quick sec, there's a study out there where they did ACT-based exposures and non-ACT-based exposures, and then told the person that the machine didn't work. It was a sort of panic disorder. And do you mind if we can do it again? And it was one of those carbon dioxide enriched environments, so it makes you feel panicky. And the people in the ACT condition were twice as likely to be willing to do it again.
Mm. Yeah.
So I think there's something to creating a willingness to be in these difficult situations.
Yeah, I agree. And as much as I like RCTs, I don't always think they're perfect. And yeah, I mean, this is all anecdotal. I've spoken to so many people on this podcast that when it was ACT and ERP together, that's when they really felt the shift in terms of people with OCD. And for some people, they just do ERP and that's the thing that shifts it.
Yeah.
So it's like you said, we're all individuals and sometimes we need different things.
Well, and if I can say one quick thing, just having been attending OCD conferences, I think the average OCD therapist is much is much kinder and more compassionate and entertaining and fun with their ERP than the manuals look.
Oh, absolutely.
Like, I think they'd actually do a pretty nice job of creating a playfulness. And I'm not saying it's psychologically flexible, but there's a different feeling than than maybe how the internet portrays it or how some TV shows portray it.
Yeah. I absolutely agree with you. And hopefully this podcast shows those therapists in that light too. Mm-hmm. Okay. So let's talk about values and how does bringing in values to exposure therapy help or aid it in any way?
Well, I think it's almost as simple as trying to think of a situation. Okay, so I live in a religious community, and so having moms who are afraid they're going to harm their child is common in the community I live in. And if I said, you know, we're going to give your baby a bath, you know, full on soap, you're going to touch your baby everywhere. You're going to wash your baby like a baby should be washed. And the disgust you feel and the fear you feel and, you know, the horror, what if all those emotions that like you look at as super negative, number one, they tell you how much you love your child. And number two, that practicing making room for that is going to enrich your life with the child and give you the ability to be there for every important moment that you want to be there for. And let's picture hugging your teen when they're struggling. And you can do that fully without your mind, you know, being all about, is this inappropriate? Like, if we do it for that, can you see why this is worth it? And a statement like that can shift what should just be an aversive situation into a meaningful one.
Yeah, they're really good illustration. I'm pausing because I was putting myself in the position of the mother and you really feel at first you're like, God, no, I don't want to do this. Like, why? And then as you go through it, okay, this makes sense. You know, it's painful, it's scary, but the reward is worth it. My values of being a good mother or father or whatever it is.
Right.
No, I like that. Okay, so very, very general question, but like you mentioned the jerk at the party metaphor earlier. What other metaphors do you like for OCD specifically?
I'll say two that I like, and I have a general statement. I do like the one of an announcer, because I think our minds talk all day long and they comment on things and they tell you that it's good or bad. And I think of it like an announcer at a sporting event. Like, you don't have to listen, but the announcer's not going to stop announcing. The other one I use quite often is the passengers on a bus, kind of the idea that you're the driver of a bus going towards your values, but the passengers are going to yell because they want to go somewhere else. They have other plans, so they're going to try to interrupt you. I use that one a lot because it has a lot of directions. But the thing I've been doing more and more, because I think I've been doing ACT long enough, is I really like to choose metaphors that match the person's interests. So when I'm training people, I really challenge them to like match things. And because you get to know your clients, you know what they're into. Mm-hmm. And then you can use examples around like parenting or sports or their hobbies, or there's usually an easy lesson in just about anything we're into.
Yeah, really good idea. And it's bound to land more if it's relevant to the person.
Yeah.
So you do the jerk at the party and there's someone that doesn't go to parties.
Right. So then like you're better off saying like, well, tell me like what you like to do with your free time than if they're like, well, I'm part of a knitting club, you know, like, okay, tell me about the people at your knitting club. And you'll find the one who's annoying or
gossip or even, yeah.
Yeah. There's going to be like some way you can twist that in, or like, you know, where's the meaning behind knitting? And they can tell you some like kind of meaningful story about, you know, maybe their mom teaching them how it's like worth it to them. And then you could say, well, isn't that kind of like, maybe it's why it's worth working on your OCD, because, you know, you could be there for your kid. Like it,
yeah,
it just connects better.
Yeah. Nice. Well, I like it. Okay. Yeah. Let's, so words of hope. So for those listening with OCD, just any words of hope that you have.
What a wonderful question. You know, like the first thing that strikes me is, I'm not them. I've never actually had OCD, or like a strong anxiety disorder, you know? So, like I'm proud of them, and like, it's super, I'm very impressed that they are working on this. You know, that they're listening to your podcast or reading a book or going to a therapist or talking to their friend or talking to their parents or, you know, whatever. Like, I think the thing I'm thinking is sort of appreciation and compassion for someone going through this. And if they're at the place that they're like listening to a podcast for some guidance, like I say, just like keep going, because things do change. Like they always change. Our emotions change, our thoughts change, like our abilities change, but like keep working on it a bit every day. And if you have a 0.5% shift every day, you'll be there. A big thing I talk to my children about, and my wife about, and myself is like, I really don't judge change on a daily basis. Change on a weekly basis might be the fastest. Like, stay at these things, work at them. But gosh, if you need to look at, am I better this month than last month? That might be a really reasonable time frame. Like that's how slowly sometimes these gains can be. They can be faster too, but you know, just stay at it. And if reading a book is where you're at right now, keep reading the book. And if you're reading half a chapter a week, like that's better than doing nothing.
Yeah, really good point.
Yeah.
Yeah, I love that. Okay, so you pick up the phone and call 20-year-old Michael. What do you tell him?
Oh my gosh, what a question. Oh, where would I be at 20? I gotta think where I was at 20. I was in Milwaukee, doing my undergrad. Honestly, I don't want to do anything in my life different. I can think of one or two instances that I wish the ball bounced a different direction. But I don't per se want them to be different, because, you know, they help make me who I am. But I'd probably say a little bit what I just said before, which is like, enjoy the ride, and it always does work out. Like, here I'm at 44. It's good. There were definitely some dives in there, but like, even on the dives, you come out into a place that's okay at the end. Like, you know, enjoy the ups, enjoy the downs. They'll average out to about a B. Actually, that's kind of a joke. All my students know that I can say my life's about a B, which I'll happily take. And I don't know if you use the same grading system.
Yeah,
ABCD. Yeah.
Yeah. I think they've actually changed it recently in the UK, but I grew up with that. So, okay. So, you've got a billboard in Utah, wherever you want it. What do you want written on that billboard?
Okay. What do I want written on that billboard? You know, my son and I was driving with him and his girlfriend, and
we were joking about this, like what would be the funniest thing to put on a billboard? And I think what we came to was like in some foreign language that like people would be like, what? So this is probably something you can delete out because it's too silly, but if you think it's funny, you can leave it. We're like write in a foreign language, like, I hope you have a nice day. Cause then everybody would be like, what is this thing on this billboard? And they'd get all worked up and then they'd go home and search it. And all it is like a kind message. We thought that was kind of entertaining. So no, I don't have anything grand.
Yeah,
no, but we were talking about this. And then we looked up how much a billboard was, and they're surprisingly expensive.
Yeah. Okay. And then lastly, just anything else that you wish you could have said today or shared?
Oh. Let me think. I think if I had to say something to people with OCD or a parent with OCD, a parent of a kid with OCD, I know who are often looking for things. To me, it's like start somewhere. Start with smart people. Like this podcast is smart. The International OCD Foundation is smart. Psychologists are good. You know, other therapists are good. Books, like professional books, are good. Like I just say, start with something, because I think sometimes it's so overwhelming. Like, what is the right move? What is the right thing I should do? Mm-hmm. And like, we get this like paralysis of what should I be working on? And, you know, if the smallest thing is setting up a consult with a therapist to like get some ideas, or, you know, going on the International OCD Foundation to learn some more, I just feel like it's almost like a behavioral commitment. Like some movement is good. And maybe it's even like exercise. Like people are like, I'm not ready. Well, then like go for a walk around the block. Like it's more than you did before. So I kind of like that idea of like working on it some, because like when I think of the things where I have deficits as a professional, like sometimes I feel overwhelmed at like how to get better at it. So I'll just start small. Like instead of buying a book on it, I'll go to like a good website on it and learn something, and then I can move to an article, and I can move to a book. And
yeah.
So I think it's kind of do something, and maybe that would even apply to a professional. Like if you're like, I don't know about that ACT stuff, it's too much. Go to the ACT website, like start there. That'll take you 15 minutes to learn a little bit. And then if you ever want to give up a whole hour, you can skim an article or something.
Yeah.
So maybe it's like a little bit can be good.
Yeah. Yeah. I like that. When I used to play basketball, my coach told me paralysis for analysis in regards to shooting. He said, if you stop and you overthink that shot, you're missing it. And I don't know, that came up for me in terms of just, you could analyze, there's so much content now about OCD and it's overwhelming. But as you say, just start somewhere and pick one thing, and that will lead you to something else. And just don't get overwhelmed by the choice.
Yes. Yes.
I mean, it's a high quality problem.
Say that again.
The high quality problem that we have.
Well, I was saying that because that's kind of what I feel in my life. Like I know about OCD, but I don't know about a lot of other things, and they're overwhelming to me. And I find, I'm kind of lucky. I can email a friend and say, well, what article should I read first? And then they say this one. And then that's helpful. Now I've started.
Yeah. Yeah. Good point. Look, thank you so much for coming on today. I really enjoyed. I wanted to speak to you. Like I said, I emailed you in 2016, so it's many years I wanted to chat with you. So it's great to get you on.
Right. So if I can go back to the 20-year-old me, I'd say when Stuart sends you an email in 2016, say yes.
Yeah.
And I can remember why I turned you down. I hope it was a good reason.
No, I don't think you got back to me. But maybe I wasn't ready for the interview. So that's
it's fate.
Exactly. Yeah. Well, thank you so much. I'm sure people appreciate it.
Thank you for listening to this week's podcast. If you enjoy the OCD Stories podcast and would like to support us with a one-time tip / donation, please go to theocdstories.com/support. All tips, no matter how large or small, are greatly appreciated. Please subscribe and rate the show wherever you listen to the podcast. Thanks also to NoCD for sponsoring the show. For more information, please click the link in the episode description. A quick disclaimer, this podcast is not therapy. It is not a replacement for therapy. Please seek treatment from a trained professional. And until we speak, take care.